from Pacifica Radio.
This
is
Democracy. This is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Speaks to Lori Berenson. It's the first time she's spoken to a reporter in 3 years since she was first arrested. We were part of the first delegation of Americans to make it inside the Peruvian prison where she's being held. Also, Chevron admits its role in the killings of protesters in Nigeria to a U.S. Congress member, stepping up pressure for a congressional investigation into drilling and killing in the Niger Delta. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Retired Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun, who wrote the 1973 decision that legalized abortion nationwide and ignited a still raging moral and political debate, died from complications following hip replacement surgery. He was 90 years old. He retired in 1994 after serving 24 years on the nation's highest court. Appointed in 1970 by President Nixon, Blackmun was considered a staunch conservative in his early days on the court, but by the time he retired, he was considered its most liberal justice. Blackmun often cast liberal votes in cases pitting individual liberties against governmental authority, but he generally voted against expanding the rights of criminal suspects. He was a champion of maintaining a strict separation between church and state. But towering above all else in Blackmun's tenure was his role in the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision and subsequent abortion rulings. In the 1973 ruling, Blackmun's well-crafted opinion cited historical materials that showed laws prohibiting abortion were relatively recent and scientific materials showing no medical justification for banning the procedure. Blackmun over the years received a number of death threats from anti-abortion groups and abortion foes picketed regularly when he gave speeches. While Blackmun stayed steadfast on abortion, he changed his views on the death penalty because of how it was applied. Blackmun initially voted to uphold the death penalty, but just a few months before announcing his retirement, he said he'd changed his mind on capital punishment and would oppose it in all instances because it was being applied unfairly. We now turn to Marsha Greenberger, president of the National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C.
In other cases, too. So I think that even Roe v. Wade, and that's been so critical, goes beyond the right to abortion in its importance. And just an example, and one of his last opinions was a constitutional decision that dealt with the exclusion of people from jury duty simply on the grounds of their gender. And it had been unconstitutional for many years to exclude people because of their race. And in striking down that practice of excluding people because of their gender, Justice Blackmun wrote a very strong decision about the nature of constitutional protection for women under the 14th Amendment of our Constitution that applies to government-sponsored discrimination that's on the basis of sex in all walks of life.
That was Marsha Greenberger, president of the National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C. Two Alabama men told the authorities this week they beat a man to death with an axe handle last month and then burned his body because the victim had previously made a homosexual advance to them. Al Bradley, a sheriff's deputy in Coosa County, Alabama, a rural area between Birmingham and Montgomery, said the two men had confessed this week after waiving their right to counsel and were then charged with the February 19th murder of Billy Jack Gaither, a 39-year-old textile worker. This news from the White House. President Clinton is hosting Italy's prime minister today, a day after a U.S. court verdict that's angered many Italians. A military jury in North Carolina acquitted Marine Captain Richard Ashby in last year's ski gondola accident in the Italian Alps. 20 people fell to their deaths when Ashby's jet sliced through a support cable. Italy's prime minister says he's baffled by the verdict, which he heard while in Boston. But the case isn't the only trouble spot between the two nations. Europe and America are on the brink of a trade war over bananas. Washington is preparing to slap 100% tariffs on everything from French handbags to German coffee makers. The tariffs are a response to European barriers to bananas exported by U.S. fruit companies. Manuel Noriega's prison sentence has been cut, and that could mean freedom for the former Panamanian dictator as soon as next year. That word from his attorney, Noriega's sentence was cut by a decade to 30 years. The 62-year-old prisoner won the reduction from a federal judge in Miami. His lawyers argued he deserved credit for helping the United States pursue its interests in Latin America while he was in power. And the United States said today it would like an international presence in East Timor, possibly involving the United Nations. A senior State Department official traveling with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright also told reporters Washington believed elements of Indonesia's military are arming pro-Indonesian East Timorese. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and kudos on your tremendous visit to Peru and the astounding experience you had there as being the first journalist to actually see and talk with Laurie Berenson in her prison cell.
That's right, Juan. I just flew in yesterday from Lima, Peru, went there on Sunday, and had the experience of going to the prison, the Socabaya prison, where Laurie Berenson is being held. Laurie Berenson is the 29-year-old American woman who is serving a life sentence for terrorism, specifically for being a traitor to the fatherland in Peru. When we got into the prison, I was there with a delegation headed by the Office of the Americas, which is a Los Angeles-based human rights group. Blaise Bonpain, who heads up that group, was there, along with a number of human rights activists. There were six of us all together. We actually were able to get into the prison, the Socabaya prison, which is in Arequipa, about an hour's plane ride from Lima, Peru, and got a chance to see Laurie Berenson for the first time. First time an American delegation has been able to see her. It's the first time a reporter anywhere in the world, including Peru, has talked to her since she was arrested on November 30th, 1995. And today we're going to talk about her case. We're going to start off by talking to her lawyer, who is here in New York. Tom Nutter is one of her lawyers, along with the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Tom Nutter, one of three attorneys for the Berenson family. The other lawyer is a Peruvian lawyer based in Lima. Nutter has represented the Berensons before the Organization of American States, and there are a number of very significant developments that have occurred over the last months, both with the United Nations, with the Organization of American States, with a State Department report that was released in the last few days saying that Peru has one of the worst justice systems in all of the Americas. But first, let's go to Tom Nutter. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, how are you?
It's good to be with you. Well, we got a chance to see Laurie. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about what that was like and what she had to say. You know, there's a different story to tell about Laurie in the United States and in Peru, because people don't follow it as much in the United States, but it's extremely significant and made news yesterday and through the week when we were in Peru, that in talking to Laurie Berenson, she said she is innocent of the charges against her and that she wants to be free. This is something that the Peruvian people and the Peruvian press have not heard in 3 years, because President Fujimori, who is the president of Peru, has not allowed her to communicate to the outside world. She's charged with being a traitor to the fatherland, something that surprised many Peruvians because she is American, for two reasons. One, for being a leader of the MRTA, which is the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, considered a terrorist group by Fujimori. Also for being part of a plan to take over the Peruvian Congress. Both charges, she says, are absolutely untrue. Tom Nutter, what is the state of her case today? She was, I should say, tried in a military court with hooded judges, never saw the evidence against her, and sentenced to life in prison.
Yes, that's correct. Within 6 weeks of her arrest, she was summarily tried, which means that she was basically interrogated. There was no other trial that she was witness to. She never was able to see any witnesses who were examined by the court or the prosecutor to make up the reports that became the court file, which is what the judge used to sentence her. Rapidly, they went through a process of two levels of appeals, and then there was an additional sort of application for review of the last appeal, which actually took quite a bit longer. Once that was finished, we filed a petition with the OAS Commission on Human Rights, which is the first step toward filing a claim in the Inter-American Court in Costa Rica. You have to first go through the commission. The commission, if the commission finds, as I'm sure they will, that Lori's rights were violated, that substantial due process was not provided in any fashion, then they themselves will be the ones that bring a proceeding in the court, unless the government of Peru relents and agrees to do something which is a little more along the lines of justice.
And Tom Nutter, what has been the response of our State Department to what is can only be called a kangaroo court proceeding that that occurred in this case?
Our State Department has made repeated and numerous but sometimes conflicting statements concerning Lori's case. They have condemned the procedure. They have called for a fair trial. At this point, after over 3 years, we believe that a fair trial, in fact, would not be possible, even if it were to occur in the normal Peruvian justice system. But be that as it may, the State Department has refrained from taking any terribly strong position publicly condemning Peru for convicting an innocent American. They have simply condemned the proceedings upon which she was convicted. We think they could make it a little bit stronger and that they could take a stronger role in this.
Well, we're going to hear exactly what the State Department, specifically the U.S. Embassy in Peru, had to say about Lori Berenson. It was pretty shocking, I have to say, to meet with Ambassador Dennis Jett, which we did after we talked to Lori Berenson. I was having trouble understanding whether he was actually the U.S. ambassador or the Peruvian ambassador in the way that he defended what has happened. We're going to hear from the delegation about what he said. And also, I have to say, talking to Peruvian press, each one that we talked to said that the U.S. Embassy is not behind Lori Berenson, something that it seems clear is a real obstacle. I mean, what we're talking about here is a strongman in Peru, Fujimori, who is holding an American woman in a prison for a life sentence, never having shown the evidence against her, saying she is a traitor to the fatherland. She could not even see the people who were trying her as they were wearing hoods. Tom Nutter, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We will certainly to continue to follow the legal developments of the case. Again, the latest developments legally, the conclusion of the United Nations High Commission for Human Rights in the last few weeks through its working group on arbitrary detention, stating that the detention of Lori Berenson is arbitrary and in violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Also, that follows the decision by the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights of the Organization of American States to give formal hearing to Berenson's petition against the government of Peru regarding wrongful incarceration. There is a majority of senators who have sent a letter saying that Lori Berenson was wrongfully convicted and asking President Clinton to do all in his power to deal with this situation, and over 180 Congress members have done exactly the same thing. But still, the Peruvian government does not allow in human rights groups, only the governmental bodies, the UN and the Organization of American States, who were investigating the case, were able to see her. And again, for the first time, An American delegation has gotten in to see Lori Berenson. I was a part of that group, being able to talk to Lori Berenson, a reporter for the first time, talking to her since she was taken on November 30th, 1995. The delegation I was with was headed by the Office of the Americas, as I said, from Los Angeles. And that delegation was headed by Blaise Bonpain. In addition to Blaise Bonpain, Lucius Walker, who is a reverend in New York and heads up Pastors for Peace, he is most known for the number of caravans that he has led challenging the embargo against Cuba. We were also with Patricia Todd, who is a part of the Office of the Americas and on the board of CISPACE, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. In addition, Annie Poole was with us, who is with a group called Guatemala Partners, a human rights group that works with victims of terror in Guatemala. And finally, Kristen Gardner. Kristen Gardner is the roommate of Lori Berenson from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and her very close friend. And just as we left Lima, Peru two nights ago, I got a chance just to talk with the whole delegation about their observations and their thoughts on the trip. This is, we'll start with Kristen Gardner. Kristen, how did you find your college roommate from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT?
Well, given what she's been through, I was relieved to see that she was doing as well as she was. But on a physical level, I was definitely first struck by how red she was in the face and by her swollen and purple hands that she used to love to play guitar with, and doesn't seem that she'll be doing that for a while. And on a psychological level, I'm concerned about the fact that she's been separated from the world for 3 years, a world that she really loves, and separated from her work for social justice that she's dedicated her life to. And during her 115 days in solitary, I think that was very difficult on her spirit. But it does seem that she has improved since she's been let out of solitary.
Lucius Walker, after you got a chance to meet her, after hearing about her and her describe her situation, what most struck you?
I was most struck by her very deep and profound commitment to social justice, not only in Peru, but in the world, in other places where she's worked and in the United States. That seems to be her first and foremost preoccupation. Secondly, I was deeply moved by her concern for others who are imprisoned on similar or at least political charges. Very deep concern that she not be treated differently, that she not be singled out, because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Peruvians who are victims of their own government's war against terrorism, unquote, in which constitutional rights have been abridged, legal justice has been thrown out of the window, and she's one among many, and she doesn't want the others to be forgotten. She's a very simple, in a sense, humble, but profound in her commitment person, and I felt inspired by her, and I felt a deep sense of identity with her commitment to social justice and concern for other people.
Patricia, one of the things that we learned along the way was the story of what happened to Lori Berenson before she was presented to the Peruvian press, which is a kind of a tradition that Fujimori has developed, where when someone is arrested for the crime of terrorism and supposedly a leader of a group, in this case she was charged with being a leader of the guerrilla group, the MRTA, the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, when she was presented, what wasn't known by the press, and we learned this a lot in going from journalist to journalist in our few days here talking to them, is what had happened to her in the days leading up to this. Even people in the United States may remember seeing Lori Berenson shouting with her face contorted about the situation in Peru. We are going to go to what Lori Berenson had to say after she'd been arrested and held, and first, though, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Y'all pushing, you're pushing it. Just relax. You're pushing it. It'll go up by itself. Don't put nothing in it unless you feel it. Let's do it again, please. They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my life come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue to bring you the conversation just that we had two nights ago in Lima, Peru, with a group of American delegation, the first to see Lori Berenson, the American who is in prison right now, life sentence in Peru, serving that for treason against the fatherland. Again, she has not seen the charges against her, and she has been charged with being a leader of the MRTV, the MRTA, which is the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement. When she was taken out to see the press, this is something that she was told she wouldn't be taken out to do. Patricia Todd, we want you to describe what the situation was, but first we'll let people hear what she had to say, and I'll translate over it.
Aquí se me condenan por preocuparme por la situación de hambre y miseria que existe en este país. Aquí nadie puede negar que en el Perú existe mucha injusticia. Existe una violencia institucionalizada que ha matado a los mejores hijos del pueblo y condena a los niños a morirse de hambre. Si es un crimen preocuparse por la situación infrahumana en que vive la mayoría de esta población.
This is Lori Berenson saying, I am to be condemned for my concern about the conditions of hunger and misery which exists in this country. Here, nobody can deny that in Peru there is much injustice. There is institutionalized violence that has killed the people's finest sons and has condemned children to die of hunger. If it is a crime to worry about the subhuman conditions in which the majority of this population lives, then I will accept my punishment. But this is not a love of violence. This is not to be a criminal terrorist. In the MRTA, there are no criminal terrorists. It is a revolutionary movement. I love this nation, the people. I love this nation, people. And although this love is going to cost me years in prison, I will never stop loving and never will lose the hope and confidence that there will be a new day of justice in Peru. And with those words, Lori Berenson was taken away. She was tried and convicted. And we now turn to Patricia Todd, who will respond to
for 11
this.
Days. And there was in there with her a woman who had been wounded. She had been shot in 5 different parts of her body. She also had a colostomy bag. Throughout this time, of course, the woman that was in the cell with her was in great pain. So Lori would do anything that she could to help her. Lori explained to us that a doctor did come to visit this woman, but that actually the doctor mocked the woman, said he shouldn't have to take care of that colostomy bag, and in general it was just very patronizing to both of them. So Lori felt it was a very degrading experience. She got very little sleep over those 11 days. She said that at night there were rats scampering around the room. Then finally, when they said that she would be presented before the press, they told her that she would only have 1 minute to speak, that there would be no microphones, and that it would be imperative for her to speak very loudly so that she could be heard. And Lori told us that she felt that this was the predominant element that causes the Peruvian people to have a negative image of her and to see her as indeed being guilty of the charges. What she thinks has not happened is that the press has not been allowed to interview her since she was incarcerated, and that prevents the Peruvian public perception from seeing what happened to her in the jail in the context of seeing the extreme suffering of this other Peruvian and others as well.
Annie Bird, you work in Guatemala, where you've dealt with a lot of people who have been tortured, where you deal with a lot of suffering, and coming to Peru is certainly a different place with different set of circumstances. But in the stories that Lori described of people who suffered in prison, I bet you found a lot of similarities with stories that you've heard in Guatemala. As we try to recreate the conversation, what struck you about what she had to say, particularly about the Yanamayo prison, the first prison she was in for 2.5 years, which was, to say the least, very cold, high altitude, and we saw the effects of it on her body still today?
What struck me about the prison in Yanamayo is that it seemed that Lori was very concerned about the other prisoners who were physically mistreated, had cerebral damage from torture, as a result of torture. She also noted that when she was moved from Yanamayo to Socobayo, it was made known in the Peruvian and international press by the Peruvian government that they did this out of a concern for her health, which she found to be strange when she knew that there were people who had been tortured and suffering extreme physical problems as a result, which were not receiving any sort of attention.
Why was she moved?
She was changed from the Yanamayo prison to the Socobayo prison in the days preceding her audience before the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights. So it seems pretty clear that the Peruvian government was attempting to put a good face forward for the International Human Rights Commission.
We not only got a chance to see Lori Berenson, but we got a chance to see the U.S. ambassador to Peru, Dennis Jett. Blaise Bonpain, you've been through a lot of interviews now in the last few days, from Associated Press to Reuters to La Repubblica to other publications. And one of the things you continually talked about was how the U.S. Embassy treated Lori Berenson on the surface and at a policy level. Can you talk about that?
I feel that the embassy's relation to Lori Berenson has been a relationship to a condemned prisoner, to a prisoner who's been condemned to death, that the authorities are nice to that prisoner, they may bring her little things, and nothing has been done to advocate for her case. Nothing at all. I consider that the ambassador here seems to represent the government of Peru quite well. He does not represent U.S. citizens that well. Here is a citizen who has been falsely accused, falsely condemned, who there is no evidence at all. There does not exist any evidence against her. And the embassy has said that they do not affirm her innocence or guilt. Well, this is in contrast to the United Nations, which has said that she is obviously detained arbitrarily. And this is in contrast to the Organization of American States, through its Commission on Human Rights, accepting her case for presentation. They feel there's a case here. This is in opposition to Amnesty International's claim that there's an urgent action here. Now, here we have international organizations that are very concerned about Lori Berenson, and our government is taking the classic position of Pontius Pilate, saying, I see no guilt in her, therefore I will allow her to be condemned. This is unacceptable behavior. The material we have from the State Department indicates that the State Department is acting in an adversarial way toward this citizen. They're acting in an adversarial way to Lori Berenson. The ambassador has shown in his office the video of her after she had been mistreated for 11 days and after she was thrust before the Peruvian press without any opportunity to take a shower, to get any sleep. And so she didn't look very well, and she was quite angry, rightfully so, at the way she was being treated. She was also very upset over the misery and the institutionalized justice in Peru. So they show that, the institutionalized violence, pardon me, in Peru. And they showed that, the ambassador showed that to visiting congresspeople here. That is unacceptable. He's advocating for the Peruvian government.
Explain what context he showed it in.
He showed it in the context of a group of visiting members of Congress. And some of them were very offended by the fact that he had done that, because he is advocating for the position of Fujimori.
Talk about the advice that he gave to the delegation that he gives repeatedly to Lori Berenson's parents.
That the advice that we should keep this as a very low profile. Keeping it as a low profile means let Lori die in prison. The Peruvians, in their Coordinadora, their human rights organization, are entirely of an opposite position, that this has to have high profile, and by having high profile, it will help the prisoners of Peru. Mr. Jett does not seem to be in sync with what is really going on. He advocated before us today for Mr. Fujimori time and time again. He even used the phrase that the Berensons had spat in the face of Mr. Fujimori. And we said, what are you talking about, Ambassador Jett? They said they had a demonstration when he came up to his daughter's graduation and they spat in his face. We said, what do you mean? He said they had a sign in opposition to Mr. Fujimori. So he did.
This was at Boston University.
Yes, at Boston University. So he is concerned about Mr. Fujimori being offended by a sign. He is not concerned about this woman being tortured for 3 years in a dungeon. Now what is this man? Who is he representing? I am very offended by this. I pay his salary, and so do you. And I like to get some service for when I pay salaries.
When we went around to the reporters, Lucius Walker, they talked about what the U.S. Embassy was doing here, whether he was advocating for them. I mean, they deal with officials a lot. Talk about their impressions of the U.S. Embassy vis-a-vis the case of Lauren Berenson.
Consistently, the media we talked to felt that the U.S. ambassador was acting more on behalf of the Peruvian government and not really acting in the interest of Lori Berenson. They stated that he, for example, continues to repeat the stories which the Peruvian government puts out about her behavior, quote-unquote, her reaction at the trial. Well, we learned that the conditions which Patricia indicated occurred immediately prior to this presentation, and he claimed today that he knew of those conditions, but he had never said that to any of the media. He had never used what he claims today he knew before, in our presence anyway, as a means of explaining the emotional state that she was in during the time of the presentation. But he continued to show the video of the presentation and to describe to media and I presume other people such as members of Congress and even others her behavior in that instance. So the sense of the media is that he is not functioning as a representative of a government would function on behalf of one of its citizens incarcerated in another country. And frankly, the media is rather puzzled about why he seems to be adverse or adversarial against her rather than seeking to achieve some fairness for her.
Let's go beyond the ambassador. In fact, a conference just wrapped up here that was put on by the Organization of American States, and Attorney General Janet Reno was here. It was on justice in the Americas. Fujimori was basically opened the conference and talked about justice. It also comes, interestingly enough, on the heels of a State Department report that was extremely critical of Peru, in fact said it had one of the worst justice systems in Latin America. Patricia Todd, let's talk about the statements of other U.S. officials. Fujimori was in Washington, D.C. in the last month. What was he doing there? What did President Clinton say when it came to Lori Berenson?
Many of us in the United States have been sending letters to President Clinton, to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Some of us have met with our congressmen and women, and we did this in January with the understanding that we had a meeting in Washington regarding Lori Berenson to see what we could do to pressure our representatives. And upon knowing that Fujimori would be coming to Washington, D.C. February 3rd and 4th requesting a loan package, we felt that this would be an opportune time, especially for President Clinton or Madeleine Albright, to bring up the matter of Lori Berenson. And as I say, we've sent faxes, we've called routinely, and we're talking about many people. And we had a postcard campaign prior to that, and many members of the Congress have signed a letter to Madeleine Albright urging her to do everything in her power to help Lori Berenson as a representative of the State Department. But nothing happened, and it is our understanding that our president, Bill Clinton, said absolutely nothing to President Fujimori with respect to Lori Berenson.
In fact, the ambassador, Dennis Jett, confirmed that. He said he had other things to discuss with the Peruvian president.
That's correct.
What impression did you get of Dennis Jett and what he felt about Lori? I did say to him, do you think that she is a terrorist? And he said he would not answer that question.
He did not directly say that he thought that she was a terrorist, but he definitely left the impression that he did think that. That he was absolutely unsympathetic to her, and at no point did he raise the at no point did he repeat Lori's assertion that she has been innocent of all charges made against her.
Kristen Gardner, you are a close friend of Lori Berenson. You were her roommate at Massachusetts Institute of Technology for the time that she spent there. And you've made a big decision in your life, and that is to drop everything that you've been doing and to organize on behalf of Lori Berenson in the Bay Area and overall in the United States. What are your plans right now? How are you going to approach this? Do you think that the battle is here in Peru, where we have been for the last few days, to change the opinion of the State Department here, to change the opinion of the public as a result of what they've seen 3 years ago, a picture of Lori Berenson, to inform the press here? What are you going to do?
Well, I think it's been clear for a while that our battle really is in the United States. It is really with the State Department and with Clinton, and that was confirmed by our visit here with the human rights group that we met with. They said that the only pressure that Fujimori and the Peruvian government responds to is international pressure, and they have seen some changes due to that international pressure along with work inside the country. At this point, I am on the steering committee of the Committee to Free Lori Berenson, and I help to coordinate the regional contacts for that. And I've been working in the San Francisco Bay Area specifically. At this point, I'm going to make this my full-time work.
Why the change? I mean, it's been 3 years. Lori has been in prison. She does face a life sentence being here in Peru for the rest of her life. Why have you decided to act now?
Well, I've certainly been concerned since I first got the call in the middle of the night that she was arrested and in prison in Peru. But initially, her parents and others of us assumed that some diplomacy on the part of the U.S. government with the Peruvian government would get her out fairly quickly. So we did not start any kind of large campaign around it, and it has become clear over time that that is really what is necessary, that our government is not going to be proactive about this until we put it on their priority list.
If people want to get in contact with this Free Lori Coalition, where can they call?
Well, first of all, they can take a look at her website and contact us through that, which is www.freelori.org, or they can call the Office of the Americas.
And that number is 323-852-9808, 323-852-9808.
And we have been talking to Blaise Bonpane, who heads up the Office of the Americas in Los Angeles, Kristen Gardner, the college roommate at MIT of Lori Berenson, Annie Poole with Guatemala Partners, as well as Patricia Todd, who is on the board of the Committee in Solidarity of the People of El Salvador, the CISPES. I went with them to Peru this week, and we got a chance for the first time to speak to Lori Berenson. It's the first time an American delegation has gotten to see her, first time a reporter has ever spoken to her since she was arrested more than 3 years ago. When we come back, final comments from Lucius Walker of Pastors for Peace, also a part of the delegation, and Blaise Bonpane. And then, Juan, I will speak with you, just brief conclusions about the trip, and then we're going to hear a remarkable admission by Chevron told to a U.S. Congress member, this about Nigeria. Stay with us, folks.
Desde aquella montaña, en donde resplandece el sol, en donde vemos todos la luna, desde allí te canto. Y aunque las cuerdas de mi guitarra lloren, el bastidor siempre sigue siendo mío. A ti te canto desde esas quebradas, en donde has derramado la sangre mis hermanos. Desde allí te canto, compañero, compañera que lucha por la justicia en nuestro país. A ti te canto, compañera. Quiero cantarte, amigo, la pena que llevo aquí dentro. Quiero decirle al viento lo que en el fondo por ti yo siento. Para cantarte a ti desde el corazón.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we finish up our conversation with the delegation that just got in to see, through, I would say, a miracle, Lori Berenson, who is imprisoned for life in Peru, charged with treason against the state, convicted in a military tribunal by a hooded judge with evidence she did not see. We're going to conclude with Blaise Bonpane, head of the Office of Americas, and Lucius Walker. I asked Blaise Bonpane to talk about his conclusions today.
I think a crime has been committed against Lori Berenson by a foreign government. It is incumbent on the President of the United States, by virtue of an act of Congress of many years now, that he investigate and take action when any citizen of the United States is apparently unjustly incarcerated. That is a clear case in this case of Lori Berenson. She deserves restitution for 3 years of wrongful imprisonment and torture, the torture of being in solitary confinement, the torture of psychological torture, the torture of the food that has caused her digestive tract injury, the torture of having her eyes harmed by solitary confinement and lack of light, the torture of her circulatory system from having been imprisoned at 12,700 feet. A crime has been committed against an innocent, nonviolent journalist who is gathering information on conditions in Peru. That is unacceptable. Our country has to take action on this.
Lucius Walker, Laurie said something very telling about her case and about the situation of the people of Peru. She said when she was at the Anamayo prison at some point, when people were on a hunger strike about conditions, an ombudsman came up, and she said to the ombudsman, she started to complain about the prison conditions. And she said he was disturbed about the fact and started to, and somehow she learned this. I don't know if he said it directly to her. That she hadn't first talked about her own case, and that that indicated that she was guilty, that she hadn't talked about herself being freed, instead came to him and complained about the prison conditions, though she did secondarily talk about her case. What did that make you think?
I was profoundly impressed with Laurie's commitment to social justice, as I said earlier. My impression of her is that she's a person of inordinate strength. To have endured what she's endured for 3 years and to be so clear and so strong in her articulation of the rights of others, and to be even so hesitant to be an advocate for herself, while to some in our society that may be a weakness because we're taught to put self first. But the strength in her is that her spirit is unbroken. Her commitment is as clear, I presume, as it has ever been. I don't see how it could be any clearer. And her articulation of all of that is done in a way that's very moving. So my impression of her is that she's not going to break. And it is incumbent upon those of us who are outside to work for not only her justice and her release, but for justice for those that she's advocating for, and for the release of hundreds of persons who are being kept in prison unjustly. She does remind me of the quote from my friend Margaret Mead, who said, never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. Indeed, nothing else ever has.
And that, Lucius Walker, head of Pastors for Peace, along with Blaise Bompain, head of Office of the Americas, two of the delegation that went to Peru this past week. I accompanied them as we got into the prison where Laurie Berenson was being held, and for the first time, a delegation got a chance to talk to her. She's at the Socabaya prison, where she has been since October, just released from solitary confinement for the last 4 months, though still a maximum security prison. And before that, she was at the Anamayo prison, high in the Andes, very cold, high altitude. She has suffered tremendously from that there for 2.5 years until the OAS started to investigate her case and she was moved. Again, Laurie Berenson, who is serving a life sentence in Peru for treason against the fatherland without seeing evidence against her and being convicted by a hooded judge. Juan?
Well, I mean, I'm sure many of our listeners are wondering why they're not able to hear Laurie herself. If you could maybe explain that.
Well, I would just say that, to say the least, it was an extremely difficult situation. No delegation has gotten in to see Laurie Berenson except for UN OAS investigators and her parents, who see her behind a double mesh. She has never spoken to a reporter since she was arrested on November 30th, 1995. So the conditions under which we spoke to her were extremely difficult. The only way we can bring you her voice is by letting you hear a little of her own music, music that she has always enjoyed playing as she has spent years in Latin America. This is Laurie Berenson.
Por ti yo siento para sentarte a ti desde el corazón para cantarte a ti.
This was music she recorded before she was imprisoned. It was one of her many cassette gifts to her parents. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to another truly remarkable and developing and breaking story, and that is Chevron's admission once again that they were behind the, or they were the company that transported in the mobile police and the Nigerian Navy into an area of the Delta where those soldiers and police opened fire on Niger Delta activists. For the past few months, Democracy Now! Has been covering Chevron's role in the killings in the Niger Delta, particularly two very serious attacks that took place last May 28th and this January 4th, when the Nigerian military and mobile police, transported by Chevron, attacked villagers and protesters, killing several and wounding many others. This is an issue that's been attracting more and more attention on the part of the media, human rights groups, and even some of Chevron's investors. Well, about a month ago, Ohio Democratic Congressmember Dennis Kucinich began circulating a letter in Congress calling for a congressional investigation into the role that U.S. multinationals play in Nigeria, particularly emphasizing Chevron's relationship to the brutal Nigerian military regime. Just last week, Congressmember Kucinich met with Chevron officials in his office, including its general manager for public affairs in Nigeria, Shola Omole, who has previously admitted on tape to Democracy Now! That Chevron had flown the Nigerian military and mobile police in May of last year to the Parabe platform in the Niger Delta, one of the areas that they do drilling, where the soldiers opened fire, killing two protesters and seriously injuring one. We are now on the phone with Congressmember Kucinich from Cleveland, Ohio. Congressmember Kucinich, can you tell us what Shola Omole and the other Chevron representatives told you in your office last week as they came to you after you started to circulate a letter calling for an investigation into them?
They basically confirmed the reports that had run earlier, particularly about the Chevron pilots operating helicopters that then carry troops to confront the protesters. Chevron conceded that the youths who were shot were unarmed. They claimed that they were shot trying to disarm the troops. However, they didn't offer any forensic evidence. They actually ended up holding the bodies of the two youths for 1 month while they negotiated with the families of the deceased over the issue of compensation. While they provided burial expenses, they didn't admit to fault or liability in the killings, but we know that they were, in effect, unarmed. They conceded that on May 28, 1998, Chevron's general manager for public affairs in Nigeria, Shola Omole, requested Nigerian troops and transported them by helicopter to the platform. And I think one of the things that was most interesting about the meeting is that there's basically a flat-out admission that this is kind of a standard operation where if there's trouble, they use their equipment to move the troops around.
Congressmember Kucinich, how did you get Shola Omole to admit that the protesters were unarmed, to admit that the Chevron held the bodies of the people who were killed? Just last week, regular listeners to Democracy Now! May remember Mike Libby, the spokesperson for Chevron in San Francisco, denying that Chevron has anything to do whatsoever in the cases of January 4th and last May 28th with the Nigerian military and mobile police.
Well, Mr. Omole was remarkably forthcoming. I mean, this is not as he was on tape in a previous interview that you're certainly aware of. And he absolutely confirmed that, the Chevron supplied and piloted the helicopters that were used to transport Nigerian troops to attack the protesters. And again, supplied helicopters and boats used in a raid on two villages. So, and the thing that needs to be understood is that Chevron's approach is that this is the way that business is done. If there's a problem, the military really doesn't have the equipment to get around, so they use Chevron, and Chevron then has the authority and the responsibility of moving the troops wherever they're needed to solve some of Chevron's problems. It's something that I think deserves the attention of Congress, and now we have Congressman Donald Payne, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, who have joined me in signing a letter to Benjamin Gilman, the chairman of the International Relations Committee, asking for a congressional investigation to be initiated into this evidence of direct collaboration between Chevron and Nigerian security forces in repression of protests. I think it's time to move forward with a full-scale inquiry on this conduct.
Well, Congressman, in the meeting, did Chevron attempt to dissuade you from continuing this this thrust, or what arguments did they possibly use to say that they were not that they could not be considered liable for the conduct that occurred on those occasions?
Again, Chevron officials were forthcoming. They were trying to explain that they are operating under circumstances in Nigeria, which they have described as very difficult, and that they claim that they certainly are not supporting anyone being killed. However, they're also supplying the means for the troops to get over there, and the consequences are certainly something that they can't disassociate themselves from. I mean, that's my belief, that they cannot disassociate themselves from the consequences. And there's a certain banality about this, which is shocking. And if the cost of doing business in third world countries involves extrajudicial killings and human rights abuses, this ought to be of interest to the United States Congress.
Congressmember Kucinich, you're sending this letter to Congressmember Benjamin Gilman, who heads up the International Relations Committee. Is it Congressmember Gilman who would have to decide whether to hold this hearing and investigation into Chevron and the other oil companies in Nigeria?
Yes, he'll have to make that decision. And I, you know, he's a very decent man, and I know that he'll take note that there's a few more members of Congress who have signed on. I'm hopeful to talk to him next week a little bit more about this so we can move this forward.
We only have 30 seconds. If people who are listening want to get involved with this issue, want to do something to move it forward, what do you suggest they do?
Well, we next week are going to begin our push on this, and I think it would be good to next week to contact Mr. Gilman's office and indicate concern that this evidence be looked at. I mean, Chevron is acknowledging things that basically public radio and Pacifica have reported earlier, and it's important that these facts be looked at. So, and also you can call up my office to indicate your support for an investigation, and we'll make sure that's included in any record.
What is your phone number?
202-225-5871.
I want to thank you very much, Dennis Kucinich, Congressmember of Cleveland, Ohio, for joining us again. His number, 202-225-5871. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. It's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Hot Talk from Cal Poly. We're here in the studios of California State Polytechnic University in Pomona, California. I'm Saul Lamb.
Pacifica Network News for Friday, March 5th. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
We are absolutely outraged that a U.S. corporation could insert itself in such a way in the burning, strafing, and violation of human rights of the people in Nigeria. This is an intolerable situation that deserves some answers. And we intend to get those answers in the Congress.
Pacifica's coverage sparks calls for a congressional investigation into the Chevron Corporation. Italy and Germany react with fury to the acquittal of a U.S. Marine pilot in the gondola death of 20 skiers. And Alabama police are holding two men who admit to killing a gay man because he made a pass. First, these news headlines. European leaders say they are shocked by yesterday's acquittal of a U.S. pilot on all charges arising from last year's deaths of 20 people in an Italian ski lift. Some Italian officials say they want to review NATO agreements so foreign soldiers can be tried in Italian courts. But Italian Prime Minister Massimo D'Alema said Italians have benefited, too, from trying their own troops in their own courts. And what's most important is that Italians have faith that justice will be done.
We expect that at the end of this process, it is clear and it is determined who is responsible, and those who are found responsible are punished through a fair trial. We are confident that this will happen.
President Clinton said the U.S. is reviewing procedures with the Italians to reduce the possibility of this tragedy happening again.
I don't know that my words could ever ease the pain of someone who lost a child or a parent or a sibling or a spouse in that terrible accident. But at least it's important for the people of Italy and for those families to know that the United States is not trying to duck its responsibility, and that we are heartbroken and horrified by what happened.
German officials have said they will lend political support to compensation claims against the U.S. Seven of the dead came from Germany. President Clinton today is relaunching the fight for Senate confirmation of Bill Lon Lee to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. The chair of the Asian Pacific American Congressional Caucus, Robert Underwood from Guam, notes Lee's record with the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund.
Bill Lon Lee is not only an exemplary candidate that has a strong legal background, an amazing record of achievement, but he actively enforces civil rights laws. And it is in an ironic way, it is because he is successful at it that he, in a sense, his nomination is drawn into question.
Lee has been appointed acting assistant attorney general since December 1997 as a way around the Senate Judiciary Committee's failure to send Lee's nomination to the floor. Committee Chair Orrin Hatch of Utah questioned Lee's support of affirmative action, which mirrored that of the Clinton administration. On Capitol Hill, two different bills have in their sights fights the lawsuits by cities against gun manufacturers, but are aiming at different targets. Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey is sponsoring the Gun Industry Accountability Act.
It will allow cities to recover federal as well as local costs when they sue the gun industry. When our legislation passes, it will have the industry looking down the double barrel of local and federal damages in these suits.
Lautenberg says the federal cost of gun violence include disability and jobless payments, Medicaid, Medicare, and veterans' hospitalization cost. But Representative Bob Barr wants to bar states and cities from filing those lawsuits. A similar bill has become law in the state of Georgia, preventing the city of Atlanta from proceeding with its lawsuit against the gun industry. In an effort to put to rest rumors set in motion by the presidential impeachment, House Majority Whip Tom DeLay said he never lied under oath, never accepted illegal honoraria, and never had an illegitimate child whom he later moved into his home as a foster child. So reports Roll Call, describing a meeting earlier this week with Republican deputy whips. In a 1994 deposition, DeLay said he had not been a company officer for 2 or 3 years, yet in his congressional disclosure form said he was chair of the board of directors. DeLay's office yesterday released a legal document dated 5 months after the deposition, in which DeLay stated he was still a director and officer with the company. As DeLay put it, "I did not commit perjury or pull a Clinton under oath." You're listening to Pacifica Network News. President Clinton and the Italian Prime Minister met at the White House, and topping their agenda was the acquittal of a U.S. Marine pilot who killed 20 skiers during a